Good afternoon. It's 5 o'clock, dark, cold, and, well, British winter in London on Tuesday. And James has just told me my guest this week is James Whittaker, and he's coming live and direct from the Cayman Islands, where it's midday, hot and sunny, and is clearly his air conditioning is working quite nicely. So as I said, I always love it when I have a guest on from Cayman, and so my guest is my friend James Whittaker, who, what to say about James, is definitely, I was going to say one of Cayman's young leaders, but I was saying that about you a decade ago. Still pretty young compared to me. very passionate about any topic he's interested in, but particularly the focus on, renewability, green energy, sustainability, and he and his business Green Tech. And industry associations, both in Cayman and his influence and presence throughout the Caribbean and beyond, is making a difference. So this is a very, very topical thing that's happening. And also life in Cayman has changed quite a bit in the last couple of months with the COVID bubble being burst. So we've not spoken since we met in person when I was across a couple of months ago. So first of all, welcome, James. It's great to see you. And I look forward to chatting.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me. Happy to be here.
So what's top of mind for you?
Well, I guess, you know, climate change, COP26, that's the hot topic right now. Our premier and a delegation from Cayman is over there. And I think it's good. I think one of the things that's been lacking here in Cayman and, you know, in most of the Caribbean has been a lack of sort of political will and sort of not understanding the value proposition of sustainable energy, how that relates to climate change, how that relates to economies. And so I think the more that our leaders and decision makers can go and have those type of conversations on sort of the global stage, the better off for us. I think they come back inspired, you know, having a bigger picture view and, you know, some of us having to sell, you know, political leaders on what the real urgency and value proposition of clean energy is, isn't quite as hard when they're immersed in it.
I'm going to honestly say that I have not paid enough attention, despite being involved in helping reshape the national energy policy in Cayman a few years ago. I've not paid enough attention to the previous accords 6 years ago in Paris and the idea of the 1.5 centigrade target, but I've got studied up on it because I think a lot of people have with COP26 and can we make it or won't we? But the whole idea of it's changed my mind a bit because if I was in a small island like Cayman or other Caribbean islands, often the excuse used is we're only small. We can't make much of a difference to carbon emissions. What I think is there's a lot more clarity around is, yes, everything has to be done by the bigger countries, China, US, etc. But everybody has to make, what's the language? And it's an NDC or something, isn't it? So it's a nationally determined contribution. Everybody's got to make a nationally determined contribution as to what they will do. And it's calculated on a per capita basis as to reduction in carbon offset to moving towards net zero. That actually makes it quite clear. And of course, there's the measurability of all of that, but it makes it quite clear as to what's your contribution going to be to reducing your carbon, which raises the temperature. And I'm just simplifying what I'd only learned myself recently, but I'm interested in I'm interested in leadership and I'm interested in behavior change. I'm not asking for you to make as political a statement as I'm about to make, but Cayman is so far behind where it could be on being green and renewable, not only in power, but in transportation, in other areas with high carbon usage. I just saw somebody, a realtor market a LEED, as in environmentally good, a LEED silver home that's 15,000 square feet. All right. That's a contradiction in terms. Nobody needs a 15,000 square foot home, no matter how efficient it is, right? So, Cayman has a long way to go. And I guess the thing is, what's in it for Cayman to be greener? And potentially at this stage, what I'm thinking is to be more credible in other areas where we need influence, whether it's financial services or which matters greatly to our economy, whether it's people, where people put their tourism dollars, their investment dollars. But I feel I'm not alone. I think people are beginning to realize what people nationally determined contributions matter, because they make a statement that you're serious playing your part, even if it is just a tiny part of a 60,000 person country.
Yeah, I would agree with that 100%. I mean, I think the reality is that, yes, you know, it's the large, you know, onshore jurisdictions, the US, Europe, China, that are the large carbon emitters. But I think if you want to have credibility to basically say, you know, we need, you know, not only financial help, and I'm saying we as the Caribbean in small island states, not just Cayman, but if we're on the front lines of climate change and sea level rise, and we need you guys to step up and do more, it's hard to do that when, like Cayman, you're one of the worst carbon polluters per capita on the planet. Yeah. So I think that you can't have hypocrisy and also stand up on the world stage and demand these things to happen if you're not willing to do them yourself. That's sort of point number one. So we certainly have to get our own house in order. And specific to Cayman, we are one of the worst carbon polluters per capita. If you take out industrialized nation, I believe we're top five. That's how bad it is.
That just to pause on that before you move on to the next point. The newspaper in Cayman did state the number, but they didn't state that simple piece of journalistic analysis, which is the per capita carbon footprint of Cayman is among the very highest on the planet at the moment.
Extremely high. I think the last time I looked at it was about 2 years ago now, and it was probably 2019 when I looked into it, and we were 26th in the world, but that included industrialized nations. You know, we don't have industry here. So if you removed industrialized nation, I think we were fifth or sixth.
Well, to give you clarity, it's nearly three times higher than the UK per capita. And this is the industrialized nation.
Yeah. So we have a long way to go ourselves as an island. And actually you said, you know, you wouldn't make the political statement. I'll make it even worse. I think Cayman's the worst island in the Caribbean. And I simply say that for the simple fact that we have more opportunity and capability and resources than almost all of our neighbors. Mm. And yet we're certainly in the bottom 10% of adoption of clean energy and reduction in carbon emissions. So I think that makes it worse for us, because we don't have to be in this position. There are, you know, lots of our neighbors that aren't as economically well off as Cayman, doesn't have, you know, great infrastructure and property infrastructure at the levels that we have then. And so, you know, we have no excuses, quite frankly. And it's really come down to the lack of historically political will. You know, that's not to say that politicians don't, you know, pay lip service to sustainability and carbon emissions and clean energy. They do. But as Greta Thunberg so aptly points out, saying one thing and not doing another is really what the status quo has been. And we've seen that here in the Caribbean, and we've seen that here in Cayman. So political will, I think, under the current government, they're saying all the right things and they're doing the right things so far. Mm. And I hope that continues. And then I think the next domino there has to be the technocrats that have to oversee this clean energy and this carbon reduction do not get in the way and are able to keep up. That's been one of the technical pain points, not just for Cayman, but I've observed that around the region, is the regulations that are required to have large amounts of carbon reduction, have large amounts of renewable energy adoption, lags behind. And so you get, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, small picture people making big picture decisions. And at the end of the day, the politicians have to ensure that doesn't happen.
If we take it to big picture, people tend to do what's good for them or what they perceive to be good for them. And one of the challenges, I was talking to somebody last week who on this weekly conversation, Roland, who's was very intimately involved with COP26. We're talking about how you change minds. If I direct it to Cayman, I think the secret is the economy running around the financial services industry. And if we, you know, think about setting an example, a few people would disagree that the top leader in politics in the Caribbean is Mia Mottley of Barbados. Right? And they've been making, and you would know more about it, you can state about it, but they've made some radical and tangible steps and declarations towards reducing their carbon footprint in lots of ways. And there has to be a linkage between that and her making an 8-minute speech on the floor of COP26, which is the most highly regarded and widely distributed speech made by anybody. Now, I would imagine off the back of that, people are going to go, I want to talk to Barbados. What are they doing? They've got a really credible leadership. They've got a clear vision for the future. And what's best for Barbados is to go to move greatly reduced carbon footprint. And, you know, it's shrunk a lot in the last 10, 20 years, but Barbados has a offshore finance industry and an educated population. So there are competitors now, which if we look 5 years ago, when this wasn't to the forefront, they weren't. But now people will go, well, what are they doing? So we might put money there. So I'm just, what are they doing? Because you're familiar with the whole Caribbean with all of this. What are they doing? What have they said? What are they doing that we could, Cayman could learn from, for example?
Yeah. So I think, you know, from a purely industry perspective, one of the things that Barbados has done well, if you look across the Caribbean, when it comes to sustainable energy and the regulations to increase adoption, Barbados and Jamaica are the two leaders right now. Once upon a time, it used to be Aruba. They had a governmental change, and then that sort of fell off the agenda. When it comes to distributed generation, meaning generation distributed on rooftops and parking lots around the country, Barbados right now is the leader in that sector. When it comes to utility scale, arguably Jamaica is the leader in that sector as well. So Barbados has put themselves on the map. The current government have certainly doubled down on renewable energy and reducing your carbon footprint.
They've also declared they're going to ban combustion engines in a certain period of time as well, right?
Yeah, they've done a lot of work on electric vehicles as well. We have done some stuff here on electric vehicles as well. Again, part of it is not going far enough, and you've got to have the Mia Motleys that are there and the Wayne Pantons that are there to say, we're going to do this. And, and for the technocrats and the people that would necessarily stand in the way of progress or not having the sort of macro understanding of why these things need to happen at the pace that they need to happen at, don't block you. And I think that's one of the things that Barbados has done well. Its leadership has said in no uncertain terms, we are going to do this and it's going to get done. And I think that's what ultimately it takes. Everything else sort of falls from there. And so, yeah, I mean, kudos to them. I wouldn't disagree that she's sort of the head leader in the Caribbean region. But, you know, like I said, I have a good lot of faith in this current government. And I hope that that Cayman can be on that stage, too, because comes to the tangibility of high levels of renewable energy adoption, of mass adoption of electric vehicles, sustainable agriculture, sustainable housing. Again, nobody has the resources that Cayman has. And you talked about changing hearts and minds. Well, I think part of it is people understanding that time is not our friend in this race, that we need to move. And that's fundamental because you, for example, have regulators who they like to push forward clean energy and carbon reduction based on the ever fluctuating price of oil. So if oil is really high, then okay, let's adopt renewables. If oil happens to fall, let's pull it back and wait a few years. That can't happen. We don't have time on our side when it comes to climate change. So we have to have that sense of urgency. And I think people need to understand that as part of, you know, understanding what the value is. But the other thing is too that today, you know, clean energy and a green economy, it's good for everybody.
Yeah.
There's not a compromise that has to be had there. This can be a huge economic juggernaut. It can be another pillar of the economy. It can create thousands of jobs and hundreds of millions of dollars in investments. It can, you know, increase Cayman's presence on the global stage. It can bring inward investment. It can do all of these things that are hugely beneficial to us from an economic perspective, not just an environmental perspective. And I think people need to understand that as well. And that's something I also don't think enough of the technocrats and the leaders that understand is this is going to have significant economic benefits to Cayman, not detrimental ones. And so, you know, when you get technocrats arguing over, you know, 2 cents a kilowatt hour rates and you get into the weeds, oftentimes the big picture gets lost.
Yeah. Well, it's good to hear that the current leadership are moving in the right direction. And, you know, the early point I was looking at was, you know, influencing people to recognize that, you know, Cayman's position on the world stage, which impacts all of our current economic pillars, is massively impacted by our stance on going green. And that will hopefully knock down the objection about, well, it doesn't matter what one small country does. But the economic pillar piece is huge. And as you know, I was born in Scotland and lived most of my adult life in Cayman, but still got close ties to Scotland. And it's quite stunning when you go over the border from England to Scotland, the difference you see in wind turbines, for example, which is the big thing there. But about 10 plus years ago, the leadership of the country similarly put a stamp down and said, we're going to be, you know, X percent renewable energy within 10 years. And it was a bolder statement than even the reports had suggested. The crazy thing was they did it several years early.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And there's certain catalysts to that, including they had an oil industry, which was running out of oil and it still is running out of oil, but it's in rundown. All the major oil companies have left. But they're retooling that city around, you know, turbines in the middle of some of the roughest waters in the world, right? Which needs new technology. Tidal power, right? They, of course, they already had a jump start on renewables because they had hydropower and stuff like this. But it's a massive employer there now. And it required a certain degree of subsidy, but it mostly required, which doesn't really get required so much anymore. But, you know, there are massive political statements being made. For example, they're banning within 5 years, they'll ban the installation of new domestic gas boilers. Right. That's a crazy statement because every house in this cold country needs central heating. Right.
Right.
And 80-90% of people use gas boilers. If people like Cayman saying you can't have a Freon air conditioner in 5 years' time, right? Yeah. And you need to find alternative solutions. So now they're using air and ground source heat pumps. And they're so new that there's hardly any companies do it. So I've got family members with massive servicing and warranty issues because the companies are the early days of some cowboys out there. The technology is only done by a few companies. Right. And they're just retrofitting old technology right now. But you turn around and go, there's going to be a market of, you know, X million houses a year that whenever their boiler packs up, they can't replace it. They need new tech.
Yeah.
And that's clear statements with subsidies being given to get the industry going. And, you know, the major sources, energy is a clear one. And that's the one that you focus on. Electric cars. Yeah, absolutely. And I know you're a Tesla guy and you love that stuff and Tesla in more than one way. But there's a massive thing that came out isn't seriously looking at, which is ground transportation, right? It's a flat island, right? And I was into cycling before I moved to Cayman 32 years ago, right? And I was blown away that there's no requirement in the planning laws to have showers and bathrooms and changing rooms in any new office buildings. There still isn't. So what did we find after Ivan? People were staying in office buildings that had generators, right? Trying to get water in trash cans. To wipe themselves down in the sink for weeks in office buildings because there weren't any showers. Now, there's still no planning requirement for it. There is not one, anybody listening from outside Cayman, one of the wealthiest countries in the world, there is not 1 meter of segregated cycle lane in Cayman. Right? Not one, and the answer to the traffic is to build more roads.
Yeah.
Right? There is no public transport system that anybody would use. Right. There is no mandatory, one thing to disable the traffic would be mandatory busing of kids to school. Yeah. You cannot drive your car within a kilometer of the school. Yeah. Right. And, you know, I'm saying things that to anybody in major urban areas of California or the UK or Canada, we go, yeah, I mean, it's not universal, but we're doing this and people should do it. And came out of going, you're crazy. It's like, I've got to drive my car. I need my three SUVs. You've got all these Chinese SUVs have come into Cayman that aren't allowed in developed countries because they're so badly built with such high emissions, but they look nice and they're cheap.
Well, there is a cultural thing that goes along with that, but the practical reality is I kind of look at transportation and housing as sort of the same fundamental problem here in Cayman in that it's a bit mad because they keep doing the same thing, expecting different results, right? So with roads, we just build more roads. We get more cars, we increase population, we just build more roads. We're going to build our way out of it. Housing, it's very much the same way. We're going to build affordable housing, but we're going to put them on big lots with tiny houses using up more scarce land, and somehow that's going to cause the price in the future to go down. Like, it doesn't make any sense. And just functionally, we can't do these things in a sustainable way, whether it's housing or transportation, without rethinking the sort of fundamentals of what it is that we're doing. So I agree with you. There's lots of things that we should be doing to incentivize biking, incentivize carpooling, getting an absolutely, critical public transportation system that makes any sense whatsoever for average people to use on a daily basis, changing over electric vehicles, providing incentives for the dealers to really start carrying those products, and government can raise the duty on fossil fuel vehicles after X amount of time. That will provide a big incentive not to import them anymore. So there's all of these sort of collective things that we need to do to come up with a transportation policy, including things like ride sharing that they're, hesitant to bring in, because, you've got all these sort of external factors with the lobby from the taxes and all of that. But again, it kind of comes back to leadership.
Yeah, I'm being very guilty here of diving into detail because I'm passionate about changing payment. And the answer, there has to be a reframing of what do we value? And we're using Cayman as example. Of what do we value and what's important to us? And it's so understandable to see that people who grew up in the 70s and 80s, they want to have a big house and a shiny car, and they want to have multiple cars because there was much less material wealth in Cayman. But yet, if you look at some of the old yards in West Bay, North Side and stuff, where people built next to each other all the time, where's the community gone? And what is it that we value, and what might we... You can never go back, but what can the Cayman of 2040 look like?
I guess the frustrating part is we know these things. Like, it's talked about ad nauseum. We talk about, live, work, and play communities, incentivizing developers. If you're going to go do a big development in Northside, make sure there's a supermarket and things that people don't have to drive to town to go and get. And then you build housing around that so people can walk. I mean, right outside my door here, the supermarket is literally 150 yards away. These are the kind of communities that we should really be heavily incentivizing to be able to do. So we know what the answer is to these things. But for whatever reason, administration after administration, it just never gets done. And I think those of us that see the urgency, see Cayman changing in a way that we don't think is sustainable and what that's going to mean for our kids and their kids. It is a little bit frightening and a little bit frustrating. Mm. I see it on the energy side a lot, but again, I also see it on transportation and housing as well. And it's going to come back down to, you're going to need leadership that understand these issues at a fundamental level. And like the Mia Motleys, will just simply not take no for an answer. And so you have to kind of have that leadership at the top. And what I've seen, at least in my own experiences, is, a political leader will come out and say X, and it'll be good, and everybody supports it, and it'll be on something on clean energy. 8 months later, he'll have a bunch of technocrats going, you really need to slow down. Let's see what the price of fuel does. If we do that, that's going to raise the cost of electricity by 1 cent. Let's just wait in the future and see what. And then they quiver, and 4 or 5 years later, we're at another election and nothing's been done. And so I've just seen that consistently throughout the cycles where, statements are made, no progress is made, and ultimately the political leaders have allowed that to happen. And I'm hoping that cycle changes here in Cayman, but unfortunately that's what I've seen. It's not that we don't know what the answers are. We do have the answers here.
Yeah. Well, those who are listening or are involved know exactly what you're talking about, and probably best not to dive into the detail because there's a bit of a global audience here. But the point you're making is a really important one. And it's, there is a very important role for civil servants and regulators to hold back politicians who aren't thinking things through and are going crazy with stuff. And that happens in every country. But we've gone way past that point when it comes to just say renewable energy. Right. There are countless examples around the world where Cayman has all these fantastic abilities to do this, And one of the, you know, but we're not doing it. And so we know exactly what to do, and the time has to come to change. One of the beauties is, and you know, I've talked about the big picture one with you, which is that there's only one company generating power at scale in Cayman, right? And it's privately owned by a publicly listed company in Canada, right? All that we need to do to really make this happen is to have our premier talk to them and reach an agreement on the future. And it's big and bold, but the answer is not to continue to use effectively diesel to generate all of the power for these big houses with air conditioning. And no, not everybody lives in a big house, but there's an enormous, you know, the huge part of that carbon footprint is the power we generate, and generating it with oil power generators. And the answer, you know, to me is not a transitional answer of using containerized gas or anything. The answer is to go to solar. I mean, you know, everybody around the world looks at it and goes, why isn't there solar hot water on the roof in Cayman? I was thinking that 30 plus years ago. Why isn't there all of this? But we've now passed the point of what's the answer. If there are technocrats sitting there going, well, we're making the decisions based upon the price of oil. At this point, a politician isn't just going to go, well, the technocrats know best. They're going to go, nah, I've just been at COP26. Hopefully Mr. Panton was talking to some of the Scottish leaders, because they've got a jump on this. And they're a small country that, to a large extent, has to do what it's told by England 10 times their size, but they have devolved powers when it comes to certain things. And they're taking, you know, Glasgow has hosted that summit, and there's fantastic credibility in Scotland around what they've done around there. So they will get massive economic benefit from this, from people going, how can we learn from you? What can we do? What companies? Although bear in mind, the company that's benefited the most from Scotland's use of predominantly wind turbines is, guess which country has made the most economic gain from it?
Denmark?
China,
okay.
Yeah. Almost Denmark, all the turbines are shipped all the way from China, because the Chinese made a play on that a number of years ago and just went, you know what, this is going to be big. We're going to manufacture them.
Yeah. I mean, I have been in rooms where regulators have said to the government, you can't tell me what to do. Shocking, and you would think that that would result in some action, because by law, the regulators have to follow official government policy. So whatever official government policy is, regulators have to have some level of autonomy. And I used to be a former financial regulator myself, so I kind of understand the dynamic. But we've had situations where, again, it's sort of the technocrats are saying, pump the brakes. Your policy might say X, but right now we think it's a bad idea. We think.
Wow.
And, you know, people, I kind of have the reputation in certain circles of not being the most patient person when I feel passionate about something. But I've sat in those rooms for quite a few years now, and I've watched the feet be dragged and the excuses be made. And at some point, somebody with more power than I have. Wow.
Let's be positive. I've known you for a decade, and you've always had big ideas, and everything has moved slower than it could have done. I saw in the news today that the people running COP have moved very fast with their analysis. They've taken all the NDCs from the first week, and they've calculated in them what it means for the global increase in temperature. And they said today, 2.4 Celsius. 2.4 Celsius means that all the money people are putting into buildings in Cayman within the next 20 years becomes valueless, because there'll be the Lloyd's market will not insure your property, right? So Cayman has to be, and the small island states have to be very loud. As you said earlier on, there is no time to wait for the oil price to drop. The decision has to be made now, and there is certainly plenty of evidence, and I hope the leadership come back from Glasgow and can turn around to technocrats and go, no, we've set the policy. Here's what it is. You now, your job is to execute it, not to question it.
Yeah.
And I can't think of another area that impacts Cayman where that kind of leadership is more important right now.
Look, I mean, once you start talking about above 2C, I mean, I think it was Hemingway had a quote that said something to the effect of, the more you know that, the more miserable you are. You know, my background is finance. I was in finance for 19 years. And when I sort of got in this industry, I started reading more and more, and I tried to keep up with the IPCC reports, and I don't dive into it because I'm not a scientist, but I like to read the summaries and see where one report is from the next report. But I don't think people here quite grasp, when I say here, small island developing states, low-lying nations, they don't quite get that, you know, when my grandchildren are my age, this place could cease to be habitable, at least in the sense that we've always known it, right, in terms of having a thriving economy. And people think, oh, well, you got to wait till, you know, the water shows up on our doorsteps to for it to be a problem. No.
No,
once Cayman ceases to be insurable, that's it.
The game is over. And that's
game is over. You're not going to have property development. You're not going to have that pillar of the economy. People are not wanting to come in to work and live here. And so you're not going to have a vibrant finance economy, which is under attack in all sorts of other ways. The way of life in Cayman, there is nothing more existential to Cayman's future than climate change. But most people think that that's sort of an alarmist thing, well, even in 2021.
I'll be.
I think most people.
I've been involved with the Lloyd's insurance market since after Hurricane Ivan in 2004. And I know people in there, and I can tell you that the people who deal with catastrophe risk, including windstorms and inundation, which is what we're dealing with in the Caribbean, right? They've been talking about this for several years. The speed of their conversation will accelerate. And you know about finance, it's capital allocation. The second they go, it's not worth it to us to insure these islands, we're done. And so this will happen 20 to 30 years before, you know, it's just going to take one really bad hurricane season.
Yeah.
And they'll start looking at it and they'll start going, mm-mm. It's really, so it's not our grandchildren being our age. It's our current children and the properties that they want to be living in and owning.
I think the economic fallout could happen in my lifetime quite easily.
Definitely.
What I'm talking about in terms of my grandchildren, my age, I'm talking about being habitable, right?
Yeah. But people, there's a great example. I can't remember the name of the island, but one of the islands in the Bahamas built a large marina, and they only raised the properties less than 3 feet above sea level, right? It was found that they could not get insurance for it at all. So like we do in Cayman, you build a kind of canal front development and people buy the lots they build on it.
Yeah.
Be that.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things to look at too is like South Florida. I mean, we don't do very many studies here, and I was happy to read the papers the other day that Cayman's doing its sort of, first, comprehensive climate change, assessment, which is good. But if you look at South Florida, the outer islands in, you know, South Beach and the Barrier Islands out there in South Florida, they've done study after study after study, and it all comes back the same thing. We're going to have to spend billions of dollars in infrastructure to not have these things underwater in the next 50 years, for South Florida to not become, you know, a wasteland of non-insurable condos that's going to cost trillions of dollars. We have to invest this money. Why would we think we're in any better situation than these folks, whether we've done an assessment or not? So the reality is I've had conversations just with, quite frankly, friends and colleagues where even when I have these conversations, they kind of just laugh it off. So, I mean, I think the reality is, you know, if you ask 9 out of 10 people on the street, do you support solar renewable energy? You're going to get 10 people out of 10 answer say yes. Are you going to do the things that it takes to reduce carbon emissions and fight climate change? Well, you know, that seems to be some problem that may or may not exist somewhere in the distant future that doesn't. But these things are intrinsically linked. I mean, these are the reasons why we're doing these things. And so,
yes,
I think that there's not a great deal of education here amongst our own people in the Caribbean and Cayman as to what the real danger is. And I've said to more than one government official, including people that work in governments, marketing and PR departments, that you're going to have to scare people with the truth and truth that you can verify, but you're going to have to show them tangibly that this is an existential threat.
I think that's the summary for me is that as we wrap up is that, you know, you had nearly 20 years experience with a very credible regulator, which is the Cayman Islands Monetary Authority. And you know, that's the core pillar of the economy in Cayman, right? And, you know, it has, the impact of this to me has to be explained in a language that people in Cayman understand, which is economics, and the impact on their well-being, their wealth, their income. And if it's, if it means that we have to invest billions into protecting, the infrastructure, if it means that we have to do our part to have any global credibility with keeping temperature change down, then the way to scare people, I think, is to talk to them tangibly. If you talk to them about temperature change by 2050, they're not going to pay attention. But if you talk to them about the fact that, by the way, everything you have worked for, which most people in Cayman put it into property in Cayman, right? Everything you have worked for will be of no value in your lifetime.
Yeah.
If we don't all pull together and make a change, this is like a war footing. And you know, we somehow need to like have that kind of communication. But, that, as you said, the positive thing is we know the answers. Cayman is very well equipped to act. And I go back to the crisis management that we did as a country after Ivan in 2004, where in each area, whether it's finance or tourism, whatever, and I was involved with tourism, the people that needed to be in the room all knew each other well, and we got in the room. And at a time of crisis, Cayman was utterly world-class in coming back from all of that. So I think we just maybe need to scare people and just get into a time of crisis and go, let's get the right people in the room. And by the way, they don't need to be overseas experts. Cayman has the people it needs in order to make these decisions. So I'm very proud of our country, and it can definitely do it if it chooses to.
I agree with you 100%.
Okay. Last words from you, James.
I think the last words from me is we need to hurry. We need urgency and we need action. And I'll do my part. I'll continue to sort of push as hard as I can. But at the end of the day, we need the leadership to come all the way from the top, and it needs to be sustained as well. It can't just be, you know, this is a hot topic for 2021 because we had COP26. It's got to be sustained for years. So that's my urging.
We need to hurry, and we need to be sustained. And I guess I will have the last word. Previous guest on the show was a lady called Catherine Sheridan. And she's been a leading sustainability consultant based out of Brussels for many years. And her last words, she said, taking the topic of the show, which is what comes next, she says, what comes next is we fry. Not so positive, but there are still ways to turn it around. Anyway, thank you so much. And I look forward to getting back out to Cayman sometime soon. And we can continue to solve all the problems and, you know, and create solutions. Okay. Thanks.
All right. Good talking to you, Tom. Have a good one.